We've got a couple things. Of course, we're going to go over the trust fund. I think there's a couple things you'll be interested in, a couple rule changes that we're looking at in the unemployment insurance division. If you remember last time, we talked about how we detect fraud and how we collect fraud, and we have a penalty assigned to that. Today, we're actually have a guest that's going to talk about how we use that money that we have collected of fraud penalties for reemployment initiatives. So we're grateful that Melissa was here. And then, of course, we'll open it up to any questions that you guys have. A couple things to start. Just for those who've been in the council for a while, and definitely recently, you've noticed that John has been unable to make it. John Pierpont, who is the executive director here at DWS, has been unable to make it. And I think that will be moving forward. So he's asked me to chair this committee or this council moving forward. And of course, he'll be available, of course, if you want to reach out to him. But it's going to be, he's not going to be attending these meetings unless it's an invitation to speak specifically about something.
Could you carry a message back to him?
Yes,
I can. Feel like we have gotten a significant upgrade.
Write that down.
Make sure that gets into the minutes.
Absolutely.
I have no problem. Great.
Yeah, make sure you spell the name right.
How could I miss that one?
He'll still be engaged. He looks at every agenda item, and I run it by him. He still looks at every committee member and does those. But as you know, DWS has grown in responsibility significantly over the last several years, and that's just a trend that seems to be continuing. So I think that it is correct for him to just kind of look at ways that he is being productive. And I think that in the end, we kept saying, well, we have to excuse him for this and for that. And in the end, I think it's just going to be more helpful if we kind of set it as that this would be I'll be chairing the council moving forward. So hopefully that helps explain it. Let's go ahead and jump in. Do we have enough people to approve minutes?
What do we need for a quorum?
Yeah, we've got to have the majority, which would be 8. With the recent resignation, it would be 7.
6. I think we
all have split personality.
Oh yeah, there are folks on the phone.
Who's on the phone?
I am. Greg Diddon.
There we go.
Hey, Greg. Good to be here. We had an operation recently.
Oh, well, I hope things are going okay. Thanks, Greg. Anybody else on the phone?
That makes
sense. Peter Asplund. Research
and General Counsel. Oh, Peter's here, but he's not on the council. So, hi, Peter.
Sorry, we're supposed to.
No, it's good to know you're there. So we'll wait. We probably have people will straggle in, and we'll see if we can approve it later. So let's jump into this. And we're just going to jump into the trust fund. We just released the tax rates. So a lot of these numbers are final for the next tax year. So let's kind of jump into this. If you look at the agenda, there's a little box there. I think it does a good job kind of summarizing some pretty critical data. It does a year-over-year comparison. You can see everything is trending correctly. The unemployment rate dropped again year over year. It's maintained at 3.1% pretty consistently now for several months, but it hasn't grown, so that's good. The duration of a claim, remember, the max an individual can receive is 26 weeks. So what this measure is showing is that on average, people stay on unemployment 12.4 weeks, which is top 10 in the nation. For lowest duration, yes. And then we're also in the top 10 in exhaustion rate. An exhaustion rate just means I am eligible, determined to be eligible for X number of weeks, and what percentage of them get to that exhaustion and actually use up the max number of weeks they're eligible for. So only 1 in 4 applicants do that or claim to do that, which is also a great indication and excellent. Both of those numbers staying low, preserve the trust fund balance, and in preserving the trust fund balance, you're able to keep those tax rates lower. So these are measures that we monitor real closely and do a lot of work around. One thing that maybe this would be a good idea to talk about sometime, Mary, is our reemployment or RESEA, how we target individuals that we see as likely to exhaust and how what services we provide to them to try and prevent them from exhausting the benefits. And then contributions collected is the amount of taxes we collected. You can see it also went down. The benefits paid is how much we're paying out to claimants. That has gone down. And then the trust fund balance has gone up, but not significantly. And that's actually kind of what we wanted to see doing as well, is not continue to grow when the demand on it is low. And then the average high cost multiple is a Department of Labor measure. And what it does is it basically looks at if you had your peak claim volume with your current trust fund at minimal contribution rate, how long could you last?
It's Richard's. That sounds like you're approaching this kind of duty.
We are stealing your guys. We're working upstairs. We're working upstairs.
If there were some orange vests and steel-toed boots, I'd feel right at home.
But so what it's looking at is the max benefits paid. That's okay. I'll sleep though. The max benefits paid at the lowest contribution rate, how long could you last paying out? And Department of Labor recommends at least one, which is 12 months. And so we're at 1.78, so we're at 1.8 years, which is the fifth healthiest trust fund in the nation. Last year was the fourth, and that's okay to go down a little bit. Again, you're trying to stabilize and not over-collect. It's been really interesting. Statute that guides how we calculate the taxes to survive an incredible recession, and it's doing really well during an incredible economic run as well. So it's actually been really tested the last 10 to 15 years in both sides. It's running really, really well. So we'll kind of dive into that.
Kevin, just a comment about that.
Yeah.
I think that you're exactly right about that average high cost multiple. You don't want to see that get to two, or because then we're over collecting for
right.
employers, and we have a trust fund that is too healthy.
Correct. And if you look at the states that are above us, they are, I think many of them are over two. But again, we haven't made any revisions to how we do it. It's just the actual statute and the way it's calculated is adjusting to this economic run that we haven't seen before. It's really interesting to see how it's adjusting and significantly reducing. And that's when you look at, if you can go to the green bar, red and blue, the next page, this one, you can kind of scan out of a little bit. So you can see the green bar behind it is the trust fund balance. That blue bar, the significant decline, that's the stock market.
It's not the stock.
That was
come
that
on,
one.
Some current politics from in
that was a better reaction.
That would be funny if we all didn't burning. Have money in the stock.
Too soon.
Too soon. We want John back.
All right. The blue is the benefits paid, and then the red is the taxes collected. And again, and we talk about this every year, you kind of want it to look like a DNA strand in that you want the red, so if you look at the 2008 to 2011, that red is the taxes collected. At the peak, when we were issuing the most in benefits, we were able to retain that tax rate at the lowest level. And that's because of the trust fund solvency. What you don't want to do during an economic downturn is increase the tax rate on employers that are already struggling. We want to keep that tax rate low. And so what happens is eventually when it right-sizes and the claims go down, you'll see now the tax rate does go up to replenish the trust fund. And you can see that has happened three recessions in a row, and then now we're just on this eight-year run without any type of economic recession or correction. And it's just kind of been plateauing, meaning that we're just paying out almost the same amount that we're receiving, which is keeping your average cost multiple the same, keeping your tax rates low, because we're basically collecting what we spend and not. Any questions about that one? Okay, and then if you go to the next one, this has a little bit more of the details. Hey, come on in.
We're that late.
If you want to grab, there's tags over there, and if you want to sign up. So, if you kind of take a look, this is also written in the statute, the minimum and maximum adequate reserve, and then in the next page you have a graph. So what we do is we calculate in statute, here is how much we have been told is a minimum reserve balance. They gave us the equation. And then here's how much is a maximum. And what you want to do is you want to monitor what's the current trust fund balance. Is it between, is it above the minimum and below the maximum? And if it is above the minimum and below the maximum, your reserve factor, which is that green bar, is 1. Meaning it just calculates the tax rate and multiplies it by 1, which in the end does nothing to the tax rate. If you get above the maximum, that number will drop as it did in 2017 when it went to 0.95, which means it multiplied it by 95%, so it dropped it by 5% and reduced that tax rate by employers. If it gets below the minimum rate, that 1 gets greater and it increases the tax rate across the board for everybody. And you can see at the peak in 2011 is at 1.45, which is when it was calculating or replenishing the trust fund that had been depleted due to the recession. So if you go to the next one, Patrick, this basically just graphs it. That blue top line is the maximum, the blue bottom is the minimum, and then the red line is the trust fund balance. And you're trying to keep that red line right in the middle between those two minimum and maximums. And again, if it's below it, it's going to jump up the tax rate. If it's above it, it'll drop the tax rate. So the question is, you can see at a point you were above the maximum, and now those blue lines continue to go up. That's actually what we discussed in the last meeting, is why are those blue lines going up? And it's because now the actual taxable wage base, meaning the number of wages being paid out, is growing. Now, we had this economic run for a long time that the wages didn't actually keep up with the economic activity, and eventually now the growth has grown up, or has continued. And what was asked last time is, and I think I still have that, just so you know, we collect annually the taxable wage base. And in 2017, which was used to calculate the 2018 tax year, we have $62.7 billion in total insured wages in Utah. This year, which is used to calculate the tax rates we just did, was $66.8 billion. So what that does is more money is flowing into the economy in the form of insured wages. More people are working. And if you have more people working at a higher wage, you have more people that are potentially eligible for unemployment at a higher dollar amount, and that causes our liability to grow, which causes those two blue lines to shift up. And that's why that red line that's been staying stagnant has now centered into the middle as that liability has gone up, or has increased. But they're all really good indicators that more people are working, they're making more wages. That's great for the economic activity. It just doesn't change that reserve factor, which can lower the tax rate for a handful of employees. Or excuse me, for a handful of employers. And we'll get to the website in just a minute, Patrick, but why don't we just end the trust fund discussion with a couple of things that I think are helpful that we just basically looked at the new tax rates. This was something we shared about 6 months ago. We looked at the new tax rates that we just sent out and re-ran the numbers, and you can see 80% of Utah employers have the absolute minimum tax rate, just based on social costs, which means 80% of Utah employers have not had experience with unemployment insurance over the last period of time. So the only thing they're paying is what's called a social tax, which is the minimum tax rate. And so 80% fall under that. And then another 11% are at the 0.2 to 0.9, and that breaks it down. Now the question is, how does that rate us nationally? And if you go to the next, go ahead and skip that. You can see that Utah in 2018, the average tax rate is 0.31, which is 44th, which remember, it's kind of inverse. 53 is the lowest, so to be 44th, that means you have one of the lowest tax rates in the nation. And then I think the next one, Patrick, does... Oh, and that has the states there, of who has a lower tax rate.
Yep. Going back a couple of screens, the number of employers that are the highest, the 560, what are some examples of types of businesses that would fall into this category that experience such a high experiential?
It's a good question. I would say the answer is seasonal work. A lot of jobs that are seasonal, it is kind of built into their expenses that I have this workforce that can only work so many months of the year. I do not want to lose that workforce, so part of the cost of doing business is they will receive unemployment during a couple months of seasonal work, which means a lot of their employees experience and use the unemployment insurance trust fund, which will increase their tax rate. But what it does is it preserves that workforce instead of them leaving and finding employment elsewhere. It can be used as a tactic to retain talent. And so that's the seasonality. That's Utah, the seasonality in Utah. And that could be both the winter season and the summer season, because there's seasonality of a lot of the ski locations and such as well.
Kevin, before we close out conversation on the trust fund, this is a really basic question. You probably answered it months ago, but where is the cash held? How is it held? I mean, is it completely liquid, 0% interest, so that you can draw on it as needed, or is it interest-bearing?
Yeah, and we actually, I think someone is going to bring that. If you remember last time, I think that was answered, and someone was doing this to me, and I misinterpreted whatever it was they were doing.
That's right.
And I'm like, 50, 60, 70, and they're like, no.
Yeah.
We actually collect it. So what we do is unemployment insurance, DWS unemployment insurance, calculates that tax rate and collects that tax rate, deposits it into a Utah trust fund that is transferred to a federal trust fund. But it does collect interest, and that interest is put into the trust fund. And the dollar amount that was collected in interest last year,
I'm not going to flash hand signs. Patrick.
42 million. What is it, Patrick?
It was in 23,900,000.
Okay. So we collected 23,900,000 in taxes. That also gets put into the trust fund, which is evaluated when calculating the tax rates as part of the trust fund.
Was that a state fiscal year performance, 12-month fiscal?
Yes, that's fiscal.
Okay, FY18.
Yes. And the trust fund, so you understand, cannot be used for administrative costs in any form. It is exclusively used to pay out claims. So that all this tax rate they're talking about does not cover any of the staffing levels that are under. And also, to be clear, I am not stealing any of your employees. We have not hired for a long time. Ours is counter-cyclical. We actually have, we have less claims, there's a calculation that's done at the national level. And so my budget is dropping annually based on the volume of claims reduction. And so we have been shrinking while trying to maintain our service levels. And we've done excellent with doing that, but we have decreased pretty significantly in our staffing levels, not because we're unable to find people, but because we have to meet the needs in our budget. But our funds are all federal funds to pay for administrative costs.
And I know that we don't have control over that interest rate and things, but keep in mind that's $23 million on $1 billion worth of principal.
Yeah.
So we're not setting the world on fire with our rate of return.
No.
And we're not taking
$23 million is a lot of money, but
we're not taking any risk though. essentially.
Well, it's the feds. I think the feds are the ones that are managing it. And quite frankly, if the feds are managing it, it's probably not being managed all that well.
Strike that from the record. Keep the stock market joking. Yeah, but I think you're right. It's not aggressive, nor would we want them to be aggressive.
No.
I mean, we wouldn't want eventually the stock market to hit, and then all of a sudden our trust fund that we have spent all this time preserving is gone. So I don't think there's any risk associated with it, but the amount of interest accrued is always going to be fairly.
Most recently, it was 2.3% interest.
2.3.
Yeah.
And then the last thing I put in there. Any other questions before I move on? Okay. The last thing I put in there that I thought that you guys might find interesting as well. I think you have this, Patrick. What I did is I looked at, I calculated how many claims we get a year and how much we paid out. So remember, as an unemployed claimant, you have your initial claim, and then I have my weekly claims. And then I have how much benefits was paid out. And so I think it's really interesting to see how fast this thing can turn. When we had this 8-year run. And if you look at 2008 to 2010, that first column, you can see it went from a 3% unemployment rate. I just marked it as January. And then in 2009, a year later, that increased to 6.3% unemployment rate. And then a year later, it jumped up to an 8% unemployment rate. And you can see our claims went from 76,000 for the year to 158,000 to 217,000. And so our workload tends to come really, really fast during an economic downturn. The week's claim went from 590,000 to almost 3 million week's claim. And the amount paid out in claims went from 142 million to, in 1 year, we actually paid out $866 million in claims. So a $1 billion trust fund, to Dave's point as well, $866 million being paid out can deplete that really, really fast. Now, that was a severe recession, so I am comparing it to a pretty severe recession. In a correctional economic downturn, we don't expect that. But you can see it can go fast if we have similar recession. And that is a smaller recession statistically in the state of Utah than the nation experienced. And that's why 35-plus states went completely insolvent and had to borrow funds, whereas Utah did not. So I think that's a really interesting one, but you can see the trend in the claims continues to go down over the next years. It's been a good run. And then the contributions collected, that's the amount of taxes collected, we're going to end, or we're projecting at $169 million for this year, which is the drop for 6 consecutive years. Straight. Dave did a video with us once that kind of talked about, hey, if you leave the money in the economy, that's great. Let businesses use it. And that's been our methodology, and it's been great. So
we should actually show that to you.
Don't ever.
Don't
we
start every meeting.
It really wasn't that great.
And then this is the press release that we sent out. You can take a look at that. We just want, hopefully the information is helpful and interesting to you. And it's a lot to digest. That's why we spend every meeting, the first part of it, just kind of rediscussing it. It's hard to remember all of it and what every graph means. But all in all, things are going great. Things are going really, really well in unemployment insurance with that trust fund. And because of it, there hasn't been a lot of activity. This legislative session, we kind of have an idea of what's coming our way, and unemployment has just not been much of a topic. So that's good news for us. All right. Now, the next thing is, okay, let's jump to this next one. So,
Kevin, before you leave that, I was just looking here. Were we within, because if we go above the maximum adequate,
yes,
then the rate automatically drops, right, by 5 basis points.
The reserve value, yes. Uh-huh.
Drops. were we within $3.5 million of?
If you look at the page, this graph right here, that has the, it's kind of the Excel spreadsheet.
Yeah, the one with the orange and the yellow, and
yep.
If you look at.
And so the answer is yes, we were within 300, a little over 300 million.
$300 million?
Hold on a second. Sorry, not 300 million. It was
$3.5 million, wasn't it?
Not 3.5, because that's 1.. Oh, hold on a second. I'm looking at the wrong.
Because it was 1.1 billion was the max, and we finished at 1 billion 97 million.
Yeah, so it's close. And that's why the 0.9, it's been teetering that time. And sometimes, I think there has been times in the past we brought this and it projected it lower. So it is close.
And that, not getting that rate cut was due primarily to the
increase in taxable wages.
In taxable wages going up and moving that.
Shifting that lineup. Mm-hmm. Again, that's a positive. And remember, the reserve factor is an impact to the 20% of employers that are not at the minimum tax rate. The reserve factor only impacts those 20%. 80% are at the minimum, so if the reserve factor goes up or down, it doesn't impact them. This is only for those that have an experience rate. So the high ones that are at the highest rate, that reserve factor going down would be beneficial to them because they'd see a drop. Anything else? All right, so this is not a legislative change, but one of the things that I introduced last meeting was a rule change that we're actually looking at in unemployment insurance, and I committed to bring back kind of a talking point about what it is we're going to do. Could you, Patrick, actually go to the next one? So you'll have two rule changes we're going to discuss today, but you'll want to look at the one, the mandatory employer online filing. I'm going to spend more time on this one because I think you'll have more interest in this one than the other one. But let's go ahead and take a look at this one. Same format, but it kind of walks through what it is that we're looking at doing. And because you're an advisory council, I want to make sure that you guys are aware of what it is we're doing and then you can give me any feedback about our projected plans. We are looking at mandating employer online quarterly filing of wages to be done online effective July 1st, 2019. Current rule only allows us to be able to do it if you have 250 or more employees. And so what we'd be doing is we'd be eliminating that rule or striking that piece out of the rule to allow a larger, to allow us to require it for all employers. Now, so if you kind of look at the talking points, it kind of walks through what it is we're looking at. 92% of employers right now already do it online, which is a great start. To me, if that number was 30%, that means why is it 30%? Is it a complicated process? If 92% are already doing it online, that to me means that the technology solution or the process is streamlined and sufficient, or else 92% of them wouldn't be doing it online already. And then online filing is a faster and more secure. Remember, what they're reporting to us is Social Security numbers and wages of individuals. And that 8% that's not online is being mailed to us in a document through the postal service. And we're not big fans of doing that for a couple of reasons. We don't like the security of it, one. But two, it also creates a manual process for us. Because in the end, we receive paper and we transpose or we take that and do data entry work of converting that paper into our system. So now, for us to process and calculate the tax rates, it has to be 100%. So that's a manual process for us. The online tool, the value of it automatically shows your tax rates. It allows you to store and kind of see past submissions, current submissions, or make amendments. Jobs.gov, 92% online, already encrypted. And here's the big one as well. The State Tax Commission already moved to mandatory online filing in 2015 for the exact same reasons for security issues. The difference between DWS and the State Tax Commission is when the State Tax Commission required it, less than 50% of employers were doing it online. So we're in a lot better place. And what we know is that employers are having to do it online with the State Tax Commission, so they have the capacity to do it online with DWS as well, is the goal.
So 100% of employers right now are compliant with the Tax Commission in filing these online.
Correct. Yeah. And if you actually, we interviewed the State Tax Commission, lessons learned, and for the most part, they have said it was a pretty non-event, that most employers were pretty comfortable with it, pretty compliant with it, and it really was a non-event to flip it. And they had a lot more to go than us. Now, what we want to do is, again, just kind of help. I'm trying to provide as much details as possible so that as you're advising, you can have as much information as that I've really been. And this is the staff, that my staff kind of gathering all this information to help us make informed decisions. So the 8% that are not filing online, 25% of them have one employee. And so I think they just have a process that this is what I do, and they've just followed that process. And that one employee, that 25%, the time it would take to file online is probably about 5 minutes every quarter because it's just one employee. They'd have to enter one employee information in and submit. 80% are about 15 employees or less. So it is mostly small employers that are struggling, or not struggling, they're just not doing it. They're not doing the online process. Now, to be fair to small employers, 90% of Utah employers with less than 15 are filing online. So it's not that it's not, small employers can't do it. Most of them are following the online process. There's just a handful that are not. And then less than 3% of paper filers are rural. So it's actually more, that was an interesting one for us too, because the thought was, well, if it's rural, is it internet access or is it something like that? And the answer is no. Most of the paper filers are actually in urban areas, and 15% are out of state. So I think what we have to do is, in order to make this thing go to 100%, I think that we have been trying to be proactive and encouraging online, and that is what has resulted in 92%. But I think the only way we can tip it to 100% is actually make it. And so here's some of the strategies that we want to do, and then we'll get to comments about what you guys' thoughts are. November, when we sent out the rate notice, we included in it, hey, we're moving towards online, start considering online. In December, we're doing an employer advisor that goes out to all employers, and that kind of outlines, here's the process, and here's why we're looking at it. We would do targeted mailings to the paper filers in January, and then again in April, and again in January. So while we'll be proactive with talking to them, we also are going to get it in writing to them three different times to let them know, hey, this isn't going to happen. We're doing a phone outreach in March. We're calling it March Madness, where we're actually going to call the paper filers and start walking through, hey, what's your reservation doing online, and try to help them there. And then we're also going to do an online tutorial. Have that available once it goes live, and we're also planning on doing online webinars where we'll actually send it out to the paper filers and say, hey, if you're concerned about doing online filing, log on to this webinar, and we'll actually demonstrate the process. Now, is this probably overdone? Yeah, I think so, but in the end, what we want to do is make sure that every opportunity is made available to these employers so that come July 1, there's not major concerns or bumps in the road. And so I have asked staff to overdo it to some extent, just to make sure that it is a kind of non-event, that for the most part it just transitions. One thing to keep in mind is July 1 is when we look at it, and then July to September, remember, if you submit your paperwork late, there can be penalties associated with that. For first-time paper filers, we're going to be lenient on those penalties. So that they can transition. Meaning, let's say they send in the paper right at the end of the deadline. We're requiring online now. We would be sending it back to them saying, hey, you got to submit these online. And then we waive the penalty so they don't get penalized, not be aware that they had to do it.
Okay.
Kevin, did I hear you say then that the targeted postcard mailings will only be to those individuals who are currently filing paper?
Correct. Yes. Yes, very targeted to here. And the reason why we're 6 months ahead of this thing is because I want all of the contributions unit, every time they talk to an employer, they evaluate whether they're paper filers and start communicating it. So that when they're doing their quarterly reports in the month of January for the fourth quarter and in the months of April for the first quarter, they already are getting multiple communications of, hey, online, we're moving towards online. Thoughts?
If you want to have your staff get us a little, just a little, yeah, a little blurb about this, we're happy to communicate to our members as well on it. And then, Kevin, once we make this conversion, does the statute require us to send rate notices out via mail?
This, I don't know if it requires us to send them out via mail. It requires us to send them out.
Right.
And what we have is an option to be paper or paperless in mailing. But that process is unaffected by this.
But do we look at the opportunity to just convert to
paperless?
Yeah, paperless, and we send out rate notices.
Yes, I would love to do that because we spend hundreds of thousands of dollars on
postage. I think the point is valid. If you're going to go to that anyway, we may just want to do a cleanup.
I think that's a good thought. That does go beyond these 8,000. Or excuse me, not 8%. It goes beyond the 8%. No, it's not that 92% are online and all 92% of those have signed up for paperless.
Right. Yeah.
That's not the case. But I think you're right in that we can take a look at it. One of the things that we did do for the initial online claim, so on the other side, claim this, is when they first sign in for their initial claim, we put it as a default that they would be paperless. And they had to go in and change it to be all paper. And we found that our take-up rate increased significantly just because it removed the additional steps they had to take to be paperless rather than, meaning we added steps to be paper instead of adding steps to be paperless. And I think that most employers are not signed up for it just because they don't know about it. So we'll go ahead and do that and push that as well. But I'm not going to I don't think it's good to mandate it now because I think we're about 30% paperless. So that's pretty far-reaching. I think it would be 70% of employers would be impacted by something like that.
I think it's something that we ought to take a look at. You probably ought to look at the statute and see if it requires
some
sort of a legislative fix. Because I'm assuming if people are filing electronically, they're going to have to provide you with contact information.
Yeah. And it really is convenient for them to get it electronically.
Right.
It's faster. And in the end, I do think it's just lack of awareness that it exists, that the option exists.
And you would think that the same people that are filing, the same person that is filing would also be the person that would want the rate notification as well.
Yeah. We'll take a look at it and make sure that as we tap into this 8%, maybe we can increase our online. But I do think, I'm not sure if it would be a statute change. It would just be that's an interesting question. I don't know if statute is so clear that it says you have to mail, meaning postage mail.
Right.
I think it just would probably outline that we have to notify, but not outline how to notify. Meaning we could do paperless. But yeah, I think operationally we spend a lot of money on paper unnecessarily. That I would love to stop.
I'm only thinking about the 3% rural, and what's our degree of confidence in that there isn't a cohort in there for which online filings would present a difficulty because of the geography?
I would say my degree of confidence is really good because of the state tax commission experience.
That's what I was thinking.
We're really not being a pioneer in this. If we were pioneering it in Utah, we wouldn't have that confidence. But because the tax commission has seen compliance, we're extremely confident that we will see the exact same compliance. Any concerns or thoughts?
I just think it's always good to have 99% to give yourself a little wiggle room. But.
Well, we're going to work with the employers, but what we're going to do is, I think it's...
I mean, in rules, you're going to be held to this, right? Your offices will be held to a 100%.
We won't put in rule 100%. Okay. All we're going to do is eliminate the... We're going to not require us to limit it to only 250 or more employees.
Gotcha.
And so it actually won't have... Okay.
Does that make sense? Yeah, that makes complete sense.
We're not putting a performance metric within rule.
Right.
We're just going to say, right now it restricts, and we're going to take out that restriction. Because it was written in, you know, historically. I mean, it's just an old rule, and it's just a matter of cleaning it up.
Hitting 100% might just be a byproduct.
Yep.
Okay.
Concerns? Thoughts? Okay, cool. Let's do this. I want to make sure that Melissa has time, so why don't we jump to her topic, and then we'll see if we have time to talk about some of the other updates on activities of the long term. Melissa, please.
I see a few familiar faces in here, so I'm I get sneaking right behind you. I'm just start saying.
Well, you can do that too. The first time that happened.
What I like about having familiar faces is we have people in the room that have benefited from the programs that we're going to talk about. So one of the things that Kevin talked about is penalties and interest associated with claims, fraudulent claims, paying quarterly taxes, untimely. That gets put into a fund where we as DWS use that fund to help employers. So depending on the economic conditions, depends on the types of programs that we use that funding for. So if you look at it in a government perspective, it's called the Special Administration Expense Account. We as DWS like to call it the Job Growth Fund because we like to use it to support employers and help maintain right now the prosperous economy and kind of be on par with that. So with those funds, some of the things that we do, we try to take innovative approaches and identify solutions to creating jobs, assisting with company expansion, retaining employees, but for the type of economic condition that we're in right now, what's the biggest pain point? Workforce. So what are we doing to help build the workforce? Some of the programs that we have funded, I'm going to actually pass around the description here. So these are current programs. Again, these have changed over time. So during recession, we've done things like assist with creating new jobs and trying to help employers find more or hire more employees because our employment rate is higher, so we're doing more of that one-on-one work. However, with most of these programs, we probably fund most of them through the Talent Ready Utah grant process, which is a competitive process for our educational institutions to apply for funding. And this could be on the through K-12 or post-secondary realm, or industry trade associations have been eligible as well. Because again, this funding comes from you, and so we want to make sure that when we're funding programs that we're doing things that are going to benefit you in the long run. One of the things that I think you'd be pleased to know is that when we do have that grant program, if it is either a public ed or post-secondary institution, we require that they have industry input. So they need to be working with a minimum of 3 employers so that we know the types of programs that they're developing are truly meeting industry need, or the types of hands-on projects that they're providing for students to really connect to real-world experiences. So you'll see in some of those descriptions that it's a pretty broad area or types of programs that we have funded in the past. But the Talent Range Trump grant program is not the sole program. You'll see that we do things for veterans. We have an ACE credentialing program where we look to tie their military experience to real world certifications and real world job titles and what that means, and help them connect those skills and help them get the appropriate certifications for skills that they already have that you may require as an employer so that they can be. So that's just one example of things that we do. Project Strive is something that we do with the National Federation of the Blind, where they prepare students by providing not only life skills, but tying those themes to career skills and what they can do to be successful in the world of work. Because they have some lofty goals to engage more of individuals that are sight impaired or blind to get into the world of work as well. So you can see that there are a variety of ways that we try to help with the workforce need that you have right now. But we really, truly reevaluate every year the types of programs that we're funding, and is that still meeting the goals and the needs of the industry and the demands that they have today. And if not, then we shift those and we rearrange and look at some other things that we can do. But we're always looking to be creative and innovative to have the biggest bang for the buck. There are some that will say, yeah, you're doing great things, but public ed, really? You've got STEM Action Center that does that. You have Perkins funding that helps with that. And one of the things that we pride ourselves in is we really engage those partners as part of our granting process. And we actually have people from USBE and public ed review the proposals that we're receiving from public ed so that they know, are they already receiving funding for this exact same program? If they are, what are they doing that's different? Because we want to leverage resources. If we can help build a program to make it go further, then we want to be able to do that, or to serve more students. Then that's something that we want to do, but we definitely want to make sure that we're not duplicating funding. So same thing on the post-secondary side. We have individuals from Utah System of Higher Education and UTEC engaged in the process, again, so that they can review those and help us identify where they see real needs. And then there's times where, you know, we receive 36 applications and proposals, and this last year we were able to fund 11. And it's just because we don't have that much funding to continue to go around, especially in times like these, because that pot of funding is not growing. And we get really good at detecting fraud, and those are all really good things, but that impacts the fund we use for this, which is why we look to leverage resources with our other partners. And so we do a pretty good job of that. I have a position that I manage with the STEM Action Center, where we share this employee, and we have had her do a really good job of, actually she's just done a good job, of taking all of the grant programs that are done by the STEM Action Center and that have been done by DWS, and creating a matrix. And so it's something that we share with our partners so that when they too are looking at other grant sources or funding opportunities for potential applicants, they can look on the list and see who's been funded and for what programs. And that's something that we share and talk about so that we make sure that we're, again, leveraging but not duplicating efforts. Some of the things that we've done this year, especially to help the workforce, you may have seen career pathways that have been announced through the Governor's Office of Economic Development. That's been a true partnership with public ed, post-secondary ed, and DWS, and we have funded almost all of those. We've received some sort of funding to help grow those programs. So usually what's tied with that would be, in a secondary world, or on a high school level, creating seamless pathways between there and articulation agreements with UTEC schools and the universities so that they're not repeating classes. So maybe a high school senior, right now we're working with Bridges office and the Weber State to develop a construction pathway. And do we have CTE pathways for our reconstruction? Absolutely. Are we doing anything new? No, but what we are doing is making sure that those CTE pathways have the elements and the standards that are acceptable by industry as part of that pathway, and that we're making sure that people know that it's a viable career option. So we look at how do we market to some of the younger kids, how do we engage the high school students so that they can be taking concurrent enrollment classes and be working with the UTech schools and the universities so that their credits transfer or that they just continue on instead of retaining those courses. So we look at it twofold. We're DWS. We work with individuals and adults to try to engage them in the workforce. But we're also working over the next year on a project called Workforce Now. So who are those that are already in the workforce but may have a degree but are in the wrong job, or maybe they have a certain skill set that they just don't know how to make a career move to make more money. And so how do we look and connect those individuals to the higher demand jobs that will get them most livable wages? So we look at all aspects, pipeline development, as well as the adults. So it's not an either or, but what can we do collectively to help meet your needs? Any questions? A little too much information? Not at all? Sometimes I'm not quite sure how far you want me to go. Yeah.
Hey, this is Greg Gibbons. How are you doing?
I'm good. How are you, Greg?
I'm fine. Hey, I just want everybody to know, if you're in charge of this program, it's going to be a major success.
Thank you.
You're a fabulous job.
Okay.
Maybe just a comment, Lisa. We've been a participant a couple of times. One of the things I think we need to just keep an eye on from an industry standpoint is that there is the requirement for the industry participation. Not all public institutions in their applications have or request or involve industry as much as I think the intent is. I think you said it requires three employers. I personally think that there ought to be some tie to an employee number tied to those employers, because we've actually had our name put on a couple of applications in the past where we were going to be involved in the program and it went through and then we were never contacted again in terms of involvement. If these funds really are penalty and interest funds that the employers are paying, I just continue to make sure that like Rich participating with Weber State, like us participating in an association, that we make sure that those industry groups are an integral part of that and not just on the application process. Because we see that sometimes where we'll have a school or someone reach out to us and we say, yeah, we absolutely want to participate, and that's about the extent
okay.
of it.
Thanks for your support.
Exactly. We have to have that. It's part of the checkoff list. We get the endorsement. But then it really doesn't go from there. And in order to verify that we're really getting what industry needs are, I just think we've got to for what it's worth, keep an eye on it. We've had a great time with UCAP funds and with Talent Ready, and I believe have had some tremendous success. One of our programs is now a big national program that we created here that I'm actually flying to California tomorrow to work on it some more with our national folks. SpaceX just got involved with it, which is pretty cool. So anyway, just from an employer standpoint, for my two cents.
That's great feedback, and that's something that we'll keep an eye out for. One of the things, we did have a concern about that initially, and if you'll remember, probably through our first couple years of our UCAP process, which is what Talent Ready grants are now, they started out as the Utah Cluster Acceleration Partnership. We asked for employer support, and we understood that to be the case. And the other thing that we wanted is we wanted employers to have skin in the game, because we had a lot of employers that said, we think this is a great idea, ATC, go forth and do your thing, and I hope it works. And they wrote a letter, and that was it. But what we really wanted was commitment. And so one thing we have changed is to address that, but it's still something that we still need to keep an eye out for. I agree with you. But we have changed it to a letter of commitment. So me as a partner, I am committed to XYZ. I will help develop the curriculum. I will help provide industry tours. I will do internships. I will have apprentices. So we really want that engagement for that very reason. And I will let you know, we do as part of our process, when we look to see if someone's named, we hurry to go to the back to see what their letter says. What does it say that they're going to do? And if it doesn't seem quite right, or if it's a form letter, that's the other thing that we did away with, we won't accept form letters, then it's something that we question. So it's, we don't go back and say we're not going to fund this, but if they come in for a presentation, then we say, hey, tell us a little bit more about this. This was a concern. Or we didn't understand this. Please help us understand that more so they have an opportunity to talk that through. But I can do a better job at making sure that through their quarterly report that those partners that they mentioned were engaged really still are. And if I see that they're not, that's something that I can say, hey, how are you working with them? And if not, then maybe make some connection. If they, you know, hey, reached out, but then weren't sure, sometimes that's the case too. They're not really familiar with the employers, and so they may, or it might have been someone that wrote it that reached out, but then now the person that's implementing it isn't the same person, so they don't really know who to call, and that's something that I try to help with as well.
And I may have missed this, so forgive me. So what roughly is the value of this fund in terms of dollars in the 11 grants that you disperse? How much is the disbursement annually?
This year it was just over $1.2 million.
Okay, that was the disbursement?
For that particular program. Yeah. Overall, our budget has decreased in the past
sure.
several years, and so I believe our request for this year is $3.5 million.
Okay. Thanks.
So it's not a huge amount. There was a time where we were able to fund more, but that penalties and interest fund had actually grown quite a bit, and we hadn't done a lot with it. And so we started doing all these programs, but we are now to a point where we don't want to spend more than what we collect. And so we make sure that amount is already in the fund before we grant funds, so that we're not in a position to say, oh, well, we granted $4 million because we projected we were going to collect that, but we only collect $1.2 million. So we look at what did we collect for the previous year so that I know that's already there. Because I don't like signing blank checks and people coming back and saying, how are we going to pay for this? So.
And Melissa's correct. And Todd's correct, too, that it is penalty and interest from employers, but it's also penalty from fraud from claims.
Yeah.
And so remember that if I fraud and receive $1,000 in unemployment claims, my Utah has 100% penalty on top of that. So the $1,000, I owe $2,000 now. The first $1,000 collected goes to replenish the trust fund. The next $1,000 goes into the P&I fund or the SAEA fund. Our percent of fraud detection has maintained the same, but instead of issuing $300 million in claims, now we're only paying out $150 million in claims. So the percentage of fraud detection is the same, but it's just the amount going out is a lot less, so that would automatically deplete how much is going into this fund. And we'll see it continue to be, it might kind of stagnate now and kind of stay a similar level, but it is certainly not growing because the amount of claims is still low.
So one other observation. We've had a great experience over the past probably year and a half getting this career pathway done. Weber State's been super good to work with. One of our observations, and Weber I think has got this, and Jeremy and the whole team has done a great job. Early on, we didn't want to have to do this in all 29 counties. So GOED and you in particular can maybe help oversee, but whatever the ultimate end game is with our work that we've been doing, we hope that becomes the model for other school districts, other technical colleges that they don't feel like, because of pride of authorship or whatever reasons, that they need to do something similar, go through a similar exercise or one up. We think that we've had a broad buy-in from technical and higher ed and public ed, and so we're comfortable. And we have had good industry buy-in as well. Sometimes we have a feeling that maybe some of the public ed people listen, but they're smarter than we are. And so they say, I know that's what you want, but we think you want this instead. And so that's become it's not something that's been a problem, that we need to make sure we stay vigilant in good listeners and making sure that we incorporate what the employers actually need, because signing an employment paycheck and education sometimes are a little bit different.
And I'm not banging on the education part off because we depend on them and we're really excited, but if we can use the model statewide, that's why Go Ed and you can kind of bring that tempering effect to every other area of the state, because I mean it's a heavy lift, and once it's done, I know we're not really excited about doing it all across the state of Utah. We've got that model.
Right.
Does that make sense?
It makes perfect sense, and I'm glad you brought that up because that's our overall goal with this, and I think we're doing a better job at that with these four or five per pathways that we have been working on together, and we're hoping that we continue to use that model. One of the great things that we're doing is actually working with Weber State. And the reason I say that is because year over, they've proven to be one of the types of institutions that says, you know what, we'll take this on. And so a very good example, last year they were funded to develop hybrid and electric vehicle maintenance training, something that we need a lot more of now where we didn't previously. So they're bringing in maintenance technicians that are already working but need those additional skills, but also the high schools. So part of their, the reason I use them is a great example. And when others call me and say, hey, what type of program should I do, or who's doing a good job, can you refer me to someone, I kind of hold them up as the gold standard, because what they did is they developed the curriculum. They had enough money in their budget to train the trainers. They also purchased electric vehicles for each of those schools that were going to be doing the training in. And these schools weren't just Ogden Weber School District. There were six additional post-secondary institutions, which included Salt Lake Community College, it included the tech schools, and it included 11 or 12 school districts initially, and they just said, we developed the curriculum, there's no reason for you to redevelop it, we will train you on it, and here you go. Go train, now you as a high school teacher can do this. And they're looking at articulating, have been articulating their programs for that same reason. You know, we taught their teachers, have the training, we know what they're being taught, we've seen the standards, and we know what they're training on, so we can accept this as a concurrent enrollment course or early college learning so that they get credit for it. Do you guys ever have any other questions or any ideas, anything you want to throw out there that you want to talk about, or you need connections to post-secondary partners on something that you want to do that will help your industry or business, let me know. I'm always happy to make those connections. One of the things I purposefully do is keep myself off the scoring committee because I like to help develop the concept. I like to make sure that we're dotting the I's and crossing the T's and making the connections that we need to make. Thank you.
Melissa,
thanks, Melissa.
We'll include when we send out the minutes, this attachment that Melissa sent out, as well as her contact information for those of you that don't have it. We're out of time, but just to knock off a couple of the last things, in your packet, there's also kind of a summary that we just did with the mandatory employer online quarterly filing for mandatory initial claim online as well. So that is a rule change that we are looking at as well, is to allow or to require online unless you meet certain criteria to file the claim over the phone. Just for a little bit of context there, remember you have your mandatory initial claim and then you have your weekly filings. DWS and UI already require the weekly filings to be online unless some criteria is met, and we're at 99% online weekly filings. So back to your question, Matt, how confident are we that they're going to be able to do this? Really confident, because it's basically just taking one step back that they initially don't have to follow the online, but after that they do, which means they could do it at initial. But we're doing similar strategies, similar communications, just to make sure that the claimant is able to do it as well. We'll still have a call center because we get a lot of questions, but it won't be for claims. And then the other thing that you'll see, because we're not meeting prior to the legislative session, one thing that you'll see in unemployment specifically is we do have an unemployment modernization fund that's available for modernization efforts. I have to ask for legislative authority to spend those modernization funds.
We've been doing it, and we have updated our benefit system into an open source technology. We went from a Versada technology that was $800,000 annually as a contract or license, and we've developed it in-house open source to eliminate that ongoing. And so now I have my benefit system in open source technology, and I have my tax system in a different technology. We're looking at where we can align those in the same technology. And so we will be asking for some modernization funds to modernize some pieces of our tax system. And what we'd be doing is imaging, which wouldn't affect employers, and the benefit overdraft. So we're not going to completely modernize the CAP system right now. We're just looking at where there's heavy alignment within our benefit system. So just be aware of that. You'll see that if you follow unemployment legislatively. That's really the only thing that I'm pushing is that. The governor did approve it in his budget, his proposed budget, so that allows me to now kind of talk about it. It's usually left within a line item of several things within DWS. Very rarely am I asked to talk about it because it's seen as a restricted fund for modernization, so there's really not a lot of controversy about it. Okay.
Probably want to go ahead and have the minutes approved.
I'll move to approve the minutes.
Oh, yes, minutes, please. Okay. Thanks, Matt. And a second? Over here? Okay, great. All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Unanimous. 2019 meetings. We're proposing the 18th of April, the 15th of August, and the 10th of December. You'll see that it's not during the legislative session, it's after the legislative
yes.
session. If something comes up that I think we should convene, we can convene over phone, if that works for everybody.
And those of us that are involved, we're happy to meet, but sometimes it's easier if we do something up on the
table. Yes.
I'm not getting my parking spot.
Yeah. I think it's going to be for unemployment insurance. I think it's going to be a pretty light session.
Those are always famous last words.
Yes. Those are famous last words. But I'm hopeful. We'll see. But if in the end I can use your opinion or if something comes up, I'll let you know. I mean, it would have to be kind of, you know, there's a lot of paid family, medical leave, like that kind of stuff has been kind of passed around in other states. It hasn't really come up in Utah much. So, but if something like that comes up, I'll schedule a meeting. We'll just meet over the phone, where maybe some of us can meet in person. Any like initial? The dates seem okay, and the frequency seem okay. About three times a year. Okay. I will entertain a last motion. Okay. Thanks, guys.
Thank you. Good move. I wasn't going to let that happen.
What's that?
2 minutes. I was watching the takeout.